Thank you very much to Catherine, John and Eric. Next week we're going to be coming from the Starmus Festival in Trondheim in Norway, where our panel will consist only of people who have actually journeyed into space, including Charlie Duke from the Apollo 16 mission. And obviously we'll be asking, did you really go to the moon?
We won't be asking that.
When you see our... I've heard that in some of the pictures you can see a shadow of Stanley
Goodbye.
Kubrick.
The, Goodbye. In the infinite
monkey cage. Do you know that nice again?
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we are in Trondheim for a very special edition of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Normally on Monkey Cage, Brian believes he has kind of parity with the guests. You know, he's done similar research or has a similar breadth of scientific knowledge. But not today, because despite some of the heights that Brian has been to, yeah, he's been up 60,000 feet in an English Electric Lightning. I myself have spent quite a lot of time up in the loft, but never have I been to the same dizzying heights of our guests, because our guests have orbited the Earth and stood on the moon. So today, what are we going to be exploring, Brian?
Well, we will be exploring the subject of human spaceflight with a panel consisting entirely of astronauts, and they are...
Hi, I'm Sandra Magnus. I have flown in space 3 times. I had 2 short-duration missions, one in 2002 to the space station. I lived on space station for 4.5 months, so I consider myself a resident of space. And then I was on the very last shuttle mission, STS-135, in July of 2011.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Claude Nicollier. I'm a Swiss citizen. I was an ESA astronaut, ESA for the European Space Agency. I was selected in the first group of ESA astronauts in 1978, was sent to Houston, but I had the great privilege of going twice to the Hubble Space Telescope on shuttle flights, including the very first servicing mission, which saved it in the sense that we fixed the optics. So since that time, it became a very useful and very wonderful instrument.
Hello, everyone. I'm Charlie Duke. I was an astronaut picked in 1966. In 72, I was selected to go to the moon. And I spent 3 days on the surface of the moon with John Young on Apollo 16. We were an 11-day mission, so I'm probably the guy up here that had less time in space. But if you get one flight, going to the moon was the one you wanted. So
I'm Terry Virts. I flew on the space shuttle Endeavour, where we delivered Node 3, which is a living module on the space station, and also the Cupola, which is the coolest module on the station. It's a 7-windowed observatory. And then a few years later, I flew on a long-duration mission. I was in space for 200 days on that flight, so about 7 months overall. But Charlie, I'll trade you.
No.
This is our panel. What an incredible panel.
Now, Charlie, you got your wings with the U.S. Navy. Was it 1958?
In 1959, actually, but I went to the Naval Academy, but I deserted for the Air Force, and I was an Air Force pilot for 29 years.
But this is, what, 3 years before Gagarin flew. So when you first, you started flying, there was no such thing as an astronaut. Was Gagarin the motivation for you? What gave you the idea?
When I was in Germany as a fighter pilot in 1961, when Yuri Gagarin went up, and then shortly thereafter was Alan Shepard. And then a couple of weeks later, President Kennedy announced we're going to go to the moon, and we're going to land on the moon, and we're going to return safely by the end of 1969. And everybody in our squadron said, yeah, sure, 15 minutes in space, we're going to go to the moon. Back then, those here old enough can remember, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, it blew up rather than lifted off most of the time. And so I didn't think we were going to make it, but I went back to MIT to get a master's degree, and I was working on the Apollo guidance and navigation system, and I met some astronauts, some of the third group of astronauts, and they were so gung-ho and so excited about this job. I made the decision, how did I get that job? And they said, well, go to test pilot school. So I did, and that was the motivation, really, was meeting these earlier astronauts like Charlie Bassett and Don Eisley and some of the other early third group.
Terry, out of the panel, you, the one who's most recently been into space, how much has the selection process changed in terms of how you can become an astronaut and the process of becoming one?
You know, one of my favorite movies is The Right Stuff. We actually watched that the night before my first shuttle launch. And it's really funny scenes about the different things they go through in selection. And it was amazing to me how similar it was. You know, some of the crazy stuff they don't do anymore, but it's still a very in-depth medical process that they go through. And there's some interviews that they try and trick you up, or, you know, they want to see what kind of person you are. And the pool is much broader now than it used to be, but in a lot of ways it's still the same.
So Charlie and Terry, you're what you might say the traditional route into being an astronaut, which is a test pilot in school. But I know, Sandy, you didn't take that route, did you? You came through engineering.
Yeah, actually, I was worried about my eyesight because my left eye is right on the borderline of what NASA was taking. And so I knew when I was in college that I couldn't go through the military because I had no chance of being a pilot. Even at that point, I don't think they were really having women fly fighters. So I was always interested in science, so I studied physics first. When I was in high school, I didn't know engineering existed, so I naturally gravitated to physics, and then I discovered engineering and eventually studied that as well. So I decided that my route to the core was going to have to be through the science and engineering fields, which was great because that's what I was interested in any way.
But you said before we started that it was middle school. There was a point where you suddenly went, this is my ambition. Was there anything, a particular event, a particular thing that you thought, yeah, that's astronaut, that's what I'm going to be?
You know, it's funny they asked me that in the interview as well, and I didn't have a good answer. I was 5 when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, so I really don't remember it very much. I remember my parents putting us in front of the TV, but I think it was just the idea of exploring and being on the edge of what people can do, and of course, who doesn't want to see the Earth from space? That just really captured my imagination, and it stuck. It's like, I've got to go do this. And I decided to try, because you never know unless you try. And, yeah, it's like maybe it could happen, and it did. So I was very, very fortunate.
Now, I know, Claude, that Sandy said you started in physics. You also started in physics and astrophysics, didn't you? I'm tempted to say what went wrong for you. And why did you...
Something went very, very, very wrong. Yeah. Well, it's true, I studied physics and astrophysics in respectively Lausanne University, Switzerland, and Geneva. I was at the same time a fighter pilot in the Swiss Air Force, because in Switzerland we do this as a part-time activity. I flew Hawker Hunters for 22 years, which is wonderful. And in a way, both skills helped me in the selection of the first group of ESA astronauts in 1978. When the Apollo program took place in the 60s and early 70s, I was in my mid-20s. I had finished my studies. I was a fighter pilot. But for me, it seemed like becoming an astronaut for a European and a Swiss citizen, it was impossible, because that's something that the Soviet Union was doing and the Americans very brightly with the Apollo program. And it's only after 1975 when ESA or the European nations were invited to participate in the shuttle program. And at the same time, the U.S. invited ESA to provide astronauts. And immediately I thought, well, that's something I want to do. And I devoted all my efforts to be successful on the first selection, which happened in 78. And it's true, I was in a way not loyal to astrophysics. I had started a PhD and I never finished it. But in a way, I became loyal again to astrophysics when I had the opportunity to go and fix Hubble, or let's say help fix Hubble with my colleagues, because that was a service to astrophysics, but in a different way than doing research in astrophysics.
Yeah, you mentioned Hubble there. I mean, were you aware of the importance of that mission at the time? I mean, obviously, it's a very expensive piece of hardware, but the impact that telescope has had on everybody, I think. Everybody has seen those images. Was that in your mind? Because that was all in the future, of course. You didn't know what that instrument was capable of.
Yeah, of course, the first servicing mission, when we had that pretty significant optical problem, so the telescope was unable to get sharp pictures of celestial objects. We were aware of the fact that the first servicing mission, STS-61, the 61st shuttle mission, during the whole preparation, we were aware of the fact that this is an important mission. And NASA made it pretty clear that there was no... failure was not an option for this mission. NASA could not tolerate another failure. There was a mistake of sending to orbit a $2 billion telescope with the wrong shape of the primary mirror. So it was important to be successful in the fixing of that problem, which was the installation of an optical corrector. We could not exchange the primary mirror of the telescope. We were well aware of the importance of the mission.
Charlie, thinking about the idea of failure is not an option, you were, before Apollo 16, you were Capcom on Apollo 11, which is basically direct communication with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin during the landing. Mm-hmm. And reading about that, it sounds like that landing on the moon, there was a level of jeopardy that last minute before actually getting the module down. Can you explain a little bit what was going on?
Well, we had a series of problems on the descent of Apollo 11. First, we had communication problems, which was causing data dropout. So we had to orient the spacecraft to different attitudes to get proper communications. Then we started having computer overloads. We had a rudimentary computer, but it was the best we had back in those days. But it was overloading and telling everybody that, hey, I got too much to do and I'm dropping off this job or whatever. So those problems persisted on the way down, but we had to make a decision, will we go or no go? Well, fortunately, we had two guys in mission control knew what was wrong, and they said, we're go flight. And so we continued on, and then we found that our trajectory was incorrect, and we had targeted them into an area of the moon that was unsuitable for landing. So Armstrong had to level off and fly horizontally for a couple of kilometers probably, and then pitch up, slow down, and then start down for a landing. Well, that took a lot of extra fuel, so now we're getting to minimum fuel. And I forgot exactly what percentage was minimum fuel, but it was the last two calls we made from mission control was 60 seconds, and that meant he had 60 seconds to land. Then I called 30 seconds, and they still weren't on the ground. And things were really tense in mission control. You know, they were close, but are we going to make it? And fortunately, we didn't get to the abort call. We landed with 17 seconds before that call. That didn't mean we were 17 seconds for fuel, but it meant that that would be the abort call in 17 seconds. But we heard contact, engine stop, and great sigh of relief in mission control because it was really tense. Are we going to make this? And sure enough, Neil Armstrong was cool, cool, cool. And he came back a couple of seconds after the touchdown and said, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. Well, I was so excited I couldn't even pronounce Tranquility. It came out twang. And And then I corrected myself, and I said, Roger, we copy you down. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. And it was a big sigh of relief in mission control, of course.
And you actually, I didn't know, but just we were talking earlier, and you said that on your mission, Apollo 16, you were very close to aborting that mission. Not quite 17 seconds, but close to not landing.
We were 1 hour before landing on the far side of the moon. And Mattingly in the command module had to change his orbit, which required the ignition of the main engine. Well, the main engine had a problem, and it sounded severe to us. And so John says, abort the burn. And that meant no landing. We were an hour before landing on the front side. So if your heart could drop to the bottom of your boots and zero gravity, ours did. You know, we were an hour from landing, and it's 8 miles beneath us was our landing spot, and they about to say, come home. So it would have been a very bitter pill to swallow, but fortunately, Mission Control looked at the data. It took them 4 hours, but they made a workaround for Mattingly, and so 4 hours later, they gave us a landing, go for landing, and then 2 hours later, we came back around and landed. So it was very close to us.
Yeah, that must have been
it wasn't life-threatening, but it was, it was just a mission abort situation.
From absolute disappointment to elation in an hour. Yeah.
We were. And then we were late landing, and so we had the flight plan had us land, power down the spacecraft, put on our backpacks, and go out and explore. Well, Mission Control said, well, now let's see here. Well, you've been, by the time you get out and get back in, you'll be awake 35 hours, and we don't want you to make a mistake, so we're going to change the plan, and we want you to go to sleep first. Well, can you imagine 4 hours after landing on the moon, say, go to sleep? And so we said, all right, and so we took off our suits and put up some hammocks, and but there was very little sleep that night, at least by me. John went right to sleep. He was amazing how he could just change his mode, if you will, and but I couldn't get to sleep for 4 or 5 hours.
I couldn't get to sleep last night just knowing I was going to meet 4 astronauts. So it's just the, it was. Can I just tell you were saying that when we were chatting before about the giddiness of, you know, you're on the moon, you kind of, you are larking about, and you said, because of course 1972 was also the Olympics on Earth as well, and you did, towards the end of your time on the moon, went, oh, we haven't done any moon Olympics yet.
Yeah,
can you say a little bit about the moon Olympics?
We had decided that at the end of every Apollo flight, somebody did something unique. Apollo 14, Alan Shepard hit a golf ball. And on Apollo 15, there was a hammer feather trick, drop a hammer, drop a feather, and they both hit the moon at the same time. So Newton's gravitational laws work. And so, we were going to do the Moon Olympics, because there was a Olympics in Munich that year. So, we were going to do the high jump. We planned high jump and then a broad jump. And, but we were running behind schedule and Houston was pushing us and, so I said, get ready to get back inside, guys. And John said, well, we were going to do the Moon Olympics. And he starts to bounce. And so I started bouncing. And so I jumped, and I was probably 3 or 4 feet, over a meter off the moon. But when I jumped, I straightened up, and my center of gravity went backwards, and over I went backwards. And that was really scary because the backpack is not designed for an impact onto the moon. And has all your electrical systems and all of your oxygen and regulators, and if it breaks, you're dead. So I started scrambling for try to break my fall, which I was able to do, and it bounced onto my back, and my heart was just pounding. And John came over and looked down and said, you okay? And I said, I think so. Help me up. So he helped me up, and my heart was just pounding, and I checked everything out, and I was okay. I'd survived this high jump record, and and then I looked up, and the TV camera was pointing at right at me, and I my wife Dottie was in Mission Control, and she said Mission Control was really, really upset. And so no more high jumps on the moon.
Yeah. Sandy, I wanted to ask you, because your experience is very different. You spent 150 days in space.
Yeah.
So I mean, actually following on there from what Charlie said, is it different now? I mean, do you get that? How has it changed in your opinion? How is it different to have long-duration space flights? And also, did they allow you to do the Olympics and things now? Or are they a bit more careful after Charlie? Maybe
well,
like, don't do that.
On the space station, they don't always see everything that you're doing. So.
Right.
So you're probably doing some things that would be upsetting to them if they could see it, but hey, the cameras are off. So it's a little bit different. You know, the difference between I can't speak to the moon, but a shuttle mission is very much like a sprint. It's very choreographed. Every 15 minutes, you've got something you've got to do. Inevitably, you're getting behind. There's contingency plans on top of contingency plans when things go wrong because you're only there for a short period of time and you have a lot to get done. So it feels very much like a sprint. When you live on the space station and you're there for months and months and months, and Terry can talk to this as well, it's a marathon. You can't work at a sprint pace for months and months and months. And, oh, by the way, if something breaks, you're going to be there next week, next month, and so forth. So everybody can slow down. And you can have a normal lifestyle because it really is, living on the space station really is moving to space. I mean, I wasn't kidding when I talked about myself as a resident of space. You adapt to a whole nother level. Your days flow into the same rhythm that you have here on the ground. You know, you get up, you go to work, you go home. It happens to be the same place, so you don't have to go far. But you develop this sort of rhythm of life. You're just doing it in microgravity with this beautiful view out the window. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Is it different, Terry, that I suppose you have a lot more time to think as well in that case. I assume that on a mission like Apollo 16, your timeline is pretty full and you probably adrenaline is there all the time. When you get that time to relax and think about your situation, does that add to the enjoyment or does it add partly to the realization of where you are in this hostile environment?
Before I did my long duration, everybody said the shuttle's a sprint and the station's a marathon. And after a few weeks during my station flight, I remember thinking, well, I've been sprinting for weeks. When do I ever slow down? It just seemed like I was always busy. But the thing that I did in my free time was take pictures. I like to take pictures of the Earth. And while I was there, we were filming an IMAX movie. It's called Beautiful Planet. And it was filmed on our spare time. Like, NASA never scheduled time to film this movie. So I basically took my spare time to film the movie. But thinking about the Olympics, Charlie, I was there during the Canadian Olympics, and Suichi Noguchi, one of the Japanese astronauts, brought skis, so we would do like ski jumping and keep on floating.
Terry, I don't know about you, but one thing you do spend a lot of time, you know, in the spare time on the space station, it's looking for stuff.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because I spend
the time in my hotel room looking at where's my room key, but in space.
If you think about moving into a house that somebody else unpacked for you, mm-hmm. and the closets are kind of scattered all over the place, and you're not quite sure what's in what closet. So you spend a lot of time actually tracking things.
Well, in a way, the secret to find things in space is Velcro.
Yeah.
You know, a table is totally useless in space because this glass of water stays on the table, and the water also is in the bottom of the glass and stays there because of gravity. Without gravity, a table is totally useless, and we replace it with Velcro. Velcro is the secret. Without Velcro, no human spaceflight possible. Yeah?
Can I tell a story about losing things in space? On our flight, on the second day, Ken Mattingly, the command module pilot, lost his wedding ring. And this volume was 300 cubic feet, so it wasn't a very big spacecraft, but this wedding ring had disappeared. So we went to the moon, and John and I landed on the moon. 3 days later, we came back, and now it's seventh, eighth day of the mission, and he's still looking for this wedding ring. The ninth day of the mission, we're on our way home, and we have a spacewalk, EVA, we call it. Mattingly gets out, and then I get out, and I'm tending his lifelines, and I look over here, and there's the Earth, 180,000 miles away, and the moon's back over here about 50,000 miles. Really amazing view, if you will. Then I get back inside in what was called the lower equipment bay, and Mattingly's now 3 meters out working on a biological experiment with his back to me in just brilliant sunlight. And all of a sudden I get this glint, and I look over, and there's his wedding ring floating out the hatch. There it is, and I reached for it, and I missed it, and so the relative velocity just took it out of the hatch very slowly, and it kept going out. And I said, it's going to hit him on the back of the head. It's going to hit him on the back of the head. And sure enough, a couple minutes later, it hit him on the back of the head, and a round helmet and a round ring, and it took a 180-degree bounce and came back towards the hatch, and about 2 minutes later, it floated back inside, and I grabbed it.
Can I ask you a question that often gets asked is why we do this? So in particular, human spaceflight. So beyond the, just that simple question, when asked it, as I'm sure you are, why do we do human spaceflight?
You know, it's funny, when people ask us, and by us, I mean either astronauts or those of us that work in the aerospace industry, why, we tend to start talking about how and what, right? Oh, well, we're going to go to Mars. Oh, we're going to build this kind of spaceship. And those are not really why answers. Those are how and what. The why, I think, and this is always a toughie because you talk to people outside of the space industry and they want concrete answers. The why is, I think, quite fundamental. We're curious as human beings. We're explorers as human beings. And we've been expanding our frontiers on the Earth for centuries, right? And now it's time to go and expand our frontiers off of the Earth. And I think it really comes down to something that simple. It helps us grow as human beings. It helps us grow as a species. It It's a natural curiosity that we have that makes us unique. Unfortunately, when you go talk to funding agencies, that doesn't resonate so much. I think it resonates a lot with the general public. And so you can then have conversations about all the practicalities of the technology spinoffs and how the exploration that we're doing in space, actually any exploration, whether it's in space or under sea, helps develop technologies and techniques and relationships and things that benefit people on Earth. I think if you look at the space station program, one of the intangible benefits of the space station program that we really don't talk about much is the fact that you've got 16 countries who've been able to work together for over 20 years to do this incredibly complex project, despite any other tensions that are going on around that project. That's huge.
After my first flight, I was in space. I landed. I was really dizzy. We went through these medical exams, got reunited with my family, and I finally made it back to astronaut crew quarters, which is like a hotel room. So whenever you get to your hotel room, you turn on the TV. So I turned on the TV, the news channel was on, and I watched it for a few seconds, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I turned it off. Like, we think this is important was the thought. A few minutes ago, I saw I was in space. There's the universe and the Earth, and now this is what we think is important. It really struck me of just how silly a lot of stuff is kind of in our daily lives. And I was thinking that 500 years from now, people are going to know Charlie Duke's name, and people are going to think that the space station was our first steps into the cosmos, and they're not going to remember whatever the policy for this thing or that thing. And like Sandy said, you know, the mission of the space station is science, and we have all these engineering, technical, you know, all of our NASA awkward engineers have all this stuff. But when I was in space, the Ukrainian Civil War was going on. Russia had annexed Crimea. The West had put sanctions. It was not all-time low, but it was pretty low between the West and Russia. And I was flying there with my cosmonaut friends, who I love. Before launch, we did a toast, and I was like, you guys are my brothers, you know? And we were like, there's this thin little piece of metal, and there's death right on the other side. And here we are trying to survive together. You know, they're like my brothers up there. And all this stuff was happening on Earth. And so, yes, science is important in these technical things, but the space station has been, I think, the best example of how people can, you know, Charlie's missions was born out of competition, but now we've become, you know, able to work together. So there's really some big picture stuff that can get lost in the daily minutia.
Do you think that it is Mars the mission, is that the correct point to be directing our next grand ambition?
Well, I think it's a logical step, because beyond the moon, this is really the celestial body that on one hand is really interesting and is accessible. It really is accessible. It takes a long time. It's not totally obvious that it's easy to settle there and get proper protection from cosmic radiation and other environmental challenges. But it is really definitely the next quote-unquote, easy step into the solar system.
Charlie, you must have... I suppose Apollo is probably one of the more well-defined space programs in that, as you said earlier, Kennedy defined it. But the broader question that we've asked there is why we do these things. You must have thought about that a lot.
Well, I think Sandy, in my view, has the answer. We're made with an inquisitive nature. There's this desire to explore that's within us, and the Mars is there, and sooner or later, I think we'll put human beings on the surface of Mars. I might not be here for it, but that inquisitive, let's go see and let's go do it.
Thank you very much to what a fantastic panel here in Trondheim. So thank you very much to Sandy Magnus, Claude Nicollier, Terry Virts, and Charlie Duke. Bye.
You're not nice again.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robin Ince. Last week we did an astronaut special from Trondheim, which means that I've spent the entirety of the last 7 days going up to strangers and saying, I met a man who's been on the moon, because I did, and it was amazing. And today, as opposed to having a man who's been on the moon, we have one of our guests who said to me, put your fingers in liquid nitrogen, and I did. Hence my nickname, Robin Three Fingers Ince.
Now, we are moving one proton up the periodic table from nitrogen this week and looking at oxygen.
Actually, oxygen is Brian's favourite molecule, the O2. He's so keen on that because that is what is pumped into the chamber where in Broadcasting House he is kept for the rest of the year to keep him as young-looking as possible. And the only reason he has a bit of grey hair is because one of the cleaners accidentally unplugged him because they were hoovering around Nicholas Parsons' chamber. Brian, by the way, is actually even older than Nicholas Parsons. A lot of people don't know that, but the chamber is very, very effective.
Do you know what? He's 1 year younger than me.
That's true. Don't work out, does it? For listeners at home who've never actually seen my face, I look very old.
People thought you were my dad, didn't they?
Yeah, in Australia. Lovely, he brings his dad on. Well done for having such a clever daughter. Anyway, so let's continue with the show.
Today we are exploring oxygen. What is oxygen? Why is it so reactive? Why is it so essential to complex living things like human beings? To help us return this programme to something worthy of Radio 4, we have a distinguished panel of guests, and they are...
I'm Andrea Saila, I'm Professor of Chemistry at UCL, and my favourite use of oxygen is to bring chemistry into disrepute by setting fire to stuff.
I'm Gabrielle Walker. I'm a former chemist. I'm also a writer, and I work with businesses on dealing with big issues, especially climate change. And my favourite use of oxygen is love, because if it wasn't for oxygen, you couldn't have two sexes, and it would make life a lot more simple, but I think a lot less interesting.
My name's Sarah Pascoe. I'm a comedian, and my favourite use of oxygen is that it's actually 2/3 of my body weight. So the only bit that's actually me is 3.5 stone. That's how much I weigh, really.
That makes it sound like you're self-loathing. Most of it's not my fault. It's the oxygen that's done it all.
Damn oxygen.
And this is our panel. Right, Andrea, we'll start off with you because for the listeners at home, you have an enormous setup here of everything from what appears to be magnets, Hessian, and digestives, which sounds like such a Radio 4 experiment. Right? Experiment will involve digestive biscuits. I like biscuits.
Or a John Peel band.
Or a John Peel band, which is Hessian and digestives. I bet there must have been a point where he gave a session to someone whose main instrument was just the sound of biscuits. I hope there was. So let's get back to the show. Well, we haven't even got there yet. Let's drive to the show. What is oxygen? What is it that makes it such an interesting gas to a chemist like you?
Well, oxygen is an amazingly reactive gas. But more importantly, we're talking about an element and one of the sort of most common elements in the universe. And when you take this element, you can bring it around in liquid form, and I've actually brought myself a little thermos.
I'm not going to have to sit my fingers in again, are we?
I'm going to put my safety glasses on.
For the listeners,
so I'm going to pour some thermos.
A flask of liquid oxygen.
And I'm going to pour it into this little bowl, and you can hear that it boils really quite violent.
What temperature is that?
So this stuff is at -185. Let's just top it up a tiny bit. But I think we should get a digestive biscuit in there because I really want to illustrate what this stuff can do. And so the digestive biscuit goes in. Let's just give it a little poke so that it goes in nice and deep. We'll feed it a little bit more oxygen just for good luck. And what it's going to do is it's going to soak it all up. I mean, digestives are quite an absorbent biscuit. I don't know whether this has tax implications. but let's just get the biscuit out. This is now a very cold biscuit. And what I want to do is to show you that when you actually soak a digestive biscuit in liquid oxygen and you light it with a match, something kind of interesting happens.
Oh.
Yay. Oh, okay. And
you see, what's really good about it is that what I've done is I've converted it into the ultimate diet digestive. Because what we've done is we've now deprived it of all nutritional benefit. And it smokes too, which is kind of nice.
So that's essentially what would happen if you ate the biscuits, but in a rather more controlled manner.
This is what happens when you eat digestive biscuits. The only thing is that biology has developed a much cleverer system than what I've got here. to actually release the energy in a digestive biscuit. Now, remember what the digestive biscuit really represents. I mean, what this is actually a bunch of sunbeams.
Aww.
It's a very romantic
object.
And what you're doing is you're essentially taking all of that solar energy that's being harvested, and then what you do, and now you can't talk, of course.
Because you're full of sunbeams.
But what you can now do is convert all of that energy, burn it using the oxygen, and use that for physiological processes.
Also, I've never, the sunbeam thing is beautiful now, because it's like if someone says, oh, I'm not fat, I'm just sunbeam intense. That's a beautiful new way of, I'm just more sunbeams, baby.
Yes, what about the exploding sheep? All the backstage chats about, oh, shh.
What is your favourite, right, if we could have, there was like shields and stuff like that, if we didn't have the regulations we have, what would have been your favourite experiment to show the reactive properties of oxygen?
I think the exploding sheep. And the name exploding sheep comes from something I showed to a small child. He was about 7 at the time. He's at university now, but he just loved it, and it involves taking cotton wool.
Can you commentate, Sarah?
Okay, so we've got the thermos has poured some liquid oxygen into a small cauldron. There's a handful of cotton wool, I'd say enough to clean your face twice. It's gone into the cauldron. The specs are back on for safety reasons. The eyelash curlers have gone in, and they are gripping onto the cotton wool. I can't hear what that is. Don't do secret bits. Oh, it's a match. It's a box of matches. The cotton wool is on the safety sheet. It's steaming a little bit.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Infinite Monkey Cage.
Could I just say quickly that no sheep were harmed in the making of this radio program?
And what a lovely reaction, because you weren't expecting that,
I was
Sarah,
very emotionally attached to that sheep.
I know.
Can we talk a little bit about you study the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And when did we first kind of understand that all that was around us was a lot more complex? The atmosphere, what is it made of?
So the atmosphere is a little bit more than 20% oxygen, and it's a little bit less than 80% nitrogen. And then there's a few little bits of things in there which are actually much more important than you'd think, considering how small the quantities are, especially carbon dioxide and water vapor. Carbon dioxide is, I call it like chili powder. It's a tiny, tiny amount of it in the atmosphere, but it's the thing that warms us up. It's a greenhouse gas that is responsible for both keeping us nicely warm and not frozen, and also is getting a little bit too over-enthusiastic in its quantity and causing global warming. However, back to oxygen, I just think it's really cool. I mean, imagine looking at the air around you. It's invisible. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. You can't hold it or do anything with it. You're not really aware that it's there. So what kind of person would look at the air and think, I wonder what it is? I wonder what it's made of. I wonder what it's got inside it and how it works. So a lot of different people did that, but the people who discovered oxygen in particular, there were two, possibly three. There's one extra guy who sort of has a claim, but my two favorites are Joseph Priestley and Antoine Lavoisier, and this is both in the 18th century. And Joseph Priestley, you would have loved him, Andrea, honestly. he was a chemist, an experimenter. And in fact, one of my favorite stories about him was he had all this glassware and stuff, and he was trying to make a gas, and he sort of lit whatever he was lighting and stepped back, and the whole thing exploded in his face. He ducked out of the way of the flying glass and then set it all up and did it again just to see what happened. Anyway, so he was very chaotic and haphazard in what he did. But he did manage to generate this gas that he could tell was different from anything else, because when he put a candle in it, the candle flared up and burned with this kind of intense brightness. And if you put a little mouse in it and left the mouse in the oxygen, it just kept on and on and on and on going. The other thing that I love about Joseph Priestley, if you'd made a new gas like that, you could see that it made candles flare up. And you could see that a mouse sitting in it, it didn't seem to do the mouse any harm. But would you breathe it? If you'd made a brand new gas, would you breathe it? Hands off, you would.
Sometimes you don't have a choice when there's a new gas in the room. No one warns you.
So he did. He was the first human being ever to breathe pure oxygen. And he said it gave him a lightness of breath. He said it was very delicious. So he sort of made it, but he didn't know what it was. And the guy who figured out what it was Antoine Lavoisier, a very cool, calculating Actually, Brian, you'd have liked him. I think about it. I can sort of see a bit of a pattern here. He liked numbers. He liked weights and measures and being very precise about things and doing equations. And he's the one who figured out that oxygen is actually a part of air, and that it's breathing oxygen is what actually makes us alive. And he did some very ingenious experiments to do it. But the story of Lavoisier is a really sad one, because after the revolution, he stayed in Paris trying to help. He was very passionate about sort of helping the poor people, but he came from an aristocratic background. And the big irony is that he had a wall built around Paris to help with the taxes that were goods that were coming in and out of Paris, and making sure that he could measure them very carefully, and he was very into precise measurements. It was his job. And they actually said about him, the reason in the end he was hauled up before the Revolutionary Council is that they said that the discoverer of oxygen, the first man to understand what it really was, that his wall had blocked off the air from the city of Paris. And so they executed him. They actually chopped his head off. And one person watching said, it took them only a moment to cut off that head, and another 100 years may not see one like it.
Mm-hmm. That's a really sad story.
He's still famous.
Yeah, he's still famous, but he's really dead.
To be fair, he would have been dead anyway.
You're right, there's a happy ending. we all die.
In terms of, so we've talked about this and seen a violent reaction with oxygen, but at a deeper level, so we go down to the atomic level and the structure of the atoms themselves, what is happening? What's the most basic description you could give, or the most fundamental description, let me say, for what's happening in these processes?
Okay, so these are very, very fast reactions, and reactions which, in fact, I mean, once you get them going, they really take off. And one of the key things is that many of these reactions involve little intermediate molecules, which are referred to as radicals. In other words, ones which have unpaired electrons. And chemists, in one way, sort of simplistically, have long imagined that if you make a molecule that's going to hang together in stable fashion, you always have to pair up the electrons. That the electrons, to say it glibly, you know, they kind of pair up just like the animals in Noah's Ark or something. Oxygen is very unusual because it doesn't do that. And the reason is because oxygen has two unpaired electrons. It's a stable molecule, in spite of the fact that those two electrons, in simplistic theory, ought to pair up. And so this was really a mystery through the sort of first, a good chunk of the 20th century. No one could work out what it was, and it really comes down to, here we are, this is the moment you've been waiting for, quantum mechanics.
All roads lead to physics.
So the interesting thing is that when we start describing the way the electrons sort of sit in these molecules, when you pair them up, you've got to imagine the orbitals, as they're called, in other words, the sort of energy levels which have particular shapes, that they overlap as you bring the two atoms together. And once you do that, you get a sequence, a kind of stack of levels into which you can put your electrons. And the same rules that govern atoms apply to molecules as well. And so one rule is the Pauli principle, that you can never put more than two electrons into an orbital, so the electrons go two by two. But then there's a second rule called Hund's rule. And Hund's rule says that if you have two identical levels, the electrons go in one by one. And that's the reason. Essentially, those two electrons, right, have individual levels to stay on, which are independent. And the result is that this molecule is highly reactive, but you can see it's kind of stable. In other words, it doesn't react with itself until you bring something else in, then excitement happens.
So if oxygen is so reactive, Gabrielle, why is the 20% of our atmosphere oxygen? Because it seems that it would react away very quickly, certainly on long timescales. So how did it get there, and why is it there today?
It's from life. It's one of the key signals. If you find a planet with oxygen in the atmosphere, you know that there has to be life there, because it's so reactive that it's going to react away from the atmosphere as fast as it's being made. And it was first made on Earth by tiny creatures. The first appearance of cyanobacteria, the first creatures to do photosynthesis. And actually, it's quite funny, because when they appeared, it was quite a while after their first appearance before oxygen showed up in the atmosphere. And that's because Everything was sort of waiting on Earth to be oxidized. In fact, the oceans rusted out. They had all this sort of floating iron that rusted out. If you're using anything made of steel, it probably comes from that big rusting event. But then eventually, when all that rusting had taken place, the oxygen showed up in the atmosphere. And that was disaster for most of the creatures on Earth. Because until that point, there hadn't been any oxygen in the atmosphere. And oxygen is dangerous. Oxygen is violent and, you know, I think of it a bit, it's like a rampaging thug, right? It wants to get those electrons and it's going to grab them from whoever it can. So if it's got that kind of protective, security guards around it when it's being delivered to a cell, all very well, but it's still going to try and rip and grab whatever it can from whoever or whatever it can get. And there were quite a lot of creatures on Earth that had never seen oxygen, never encountered it and couldn't take it. There was mass mortality on Earth. It was a poison. And the creatures that did survive by burying themselves. That's why in the bottoms are kind of muddy lakes. When you kind of, if you dig in there, it's a bit smelly and strange because all the creatures that can't cope with oxygen actually are there. And it's also, by the way, why we fart. Because the creatures that actually make the methane inside our guts have buried themselves there to try and get away from oxygen. So it was a big poison. It was a big poison. But here's the really cool thing about it. As the oxygen began to get build up more and more and more in the atmosphere, eventually, about 600 million years ago, you got the very first animals. You got the first multicelled creatures. You got the first eyes and teeth and legs and cells and brains and hair and everything that's vivid and interesting. The first creatures that could move around, the first creatures that could do stuff. And that's because they had oxygen. It has to be something really powerful to be as big and vigorous and inventive as we are.
So the current thinking, though oxygen is not vital for life, would you say that current thinking is that oxygen for complex life, with our current theory of perhaps, you know, life on other planets and the possibility of that?
Basically, as far as we know, if you want to be bigger than a pinhead...
I do.
You want to be bigger than a pinhead and you don't want to be slime. That's the other
thing. I do. They're the two things. They are my two ambitions in life.
Then keep breathing.
Yeah, I will. Thank you. This is really good advice, everyone.
I think you should write it down.
I'm going to write it down, yeah, just in case I forget New Year's resolutions.
We're just running out of time. To summarise, though, we've been talking about the atmosphere, but this thing, oxygen, for a chemist, is it one of the ultimate building blocks, the ultimate element in terms of its reactivity and the role it plays, I suppose, the profound role it plays?
I mean, oxygen plays a hugely profound role in chemistry because not only does it form such incredibly sort of stable molecules, but one of the things that it does is when you put it into a molecule, one thing that it often does is it distorts the charges. In other words, it leaves more positive on one side and it tends to be more negative. And the moment you do that with molecules, what they do is they start to kind of stick together. You start to build in a kind of chemical stickiness, a kind of chemical bias, which A, makes things condense, makes them into liquids, into solids. I mean, one of the key things about water, for example, is that you have oxygen attached to hydrogen. The hydrogens are positive. The oxygen is negative. That makes those water molecules stick together. It gives ice its weird structure and its properties. And it's all driven by the real fundamental difference between hydrogen and oxygen, right? That charge difference. So oxygen is one of these kind of, in a way, really iconic elements in the periodic table, one that is such an important contributor to our world. And, yeah, if we didn't have oxygen, I mean, my God, what would we have to play with? Fluorine! Even better!
Can I just say, for listeners at home, mad scientist face was suddenly seen there.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I wonder. I have to ask, when I stuck my finger in the liquid nitrogen, right, a couple of series ago, I was worried that I would just go, oh, don't take it out again. You know that bit where your brain makes you back? Do you ever pour out liquid oxygen and think, I know I shouldn't drink it. Why is my brain going, go on, drink it? Because that's one of the reasons I never became a chemist. I just didn't, I know I shouldn't drink the mercury, but go on.
Drinking oxygen is not something I've ever been tempted to do, but, you know, unlike Bill Clinton, I certainly like to inhale.
It just sounded, describing oxygen, so we discussed, you could imagine a universe that where life can exist without oxygen in an atmosphere, obviously, because that was the state of the Earth when life began. But as you mentioned there, water, the properties are unique and profoundly dependent on the chemistry of oxygen. Could you imagine a universe with no oxygen but life?
Well, look, I think that's a very, very difficult question on one level. I mean, we know that there are life forms on Earth that have nothing to do with molecular oxygen. In other words, down at those kind of volcanic vents down in the depths of the sea, you have all kinds of chemistry and life, which is sort of driven by chemistry involving other elements. And remember, it's always this business of being able to transfer electrons around in order to be able to split bonds, in order to make bonds, to build structures, and so on. But if, in fact, you didn't have oxygen, I mean, that would change things very, very profoundly. Because one of the wonderful things about having oxygen is water, and the fact that it has such a high boiling point compared to any other molecule of its size, right? There's nothing comparable to that. And it's got this nice liquid range. It will dissolve, you know, water will dissolve such a wide range of things, particularly salts, but also molecules which don't sort of ionize, which aren't as charged like that. And so I think without oxygen, you really struggle to imagine. And yet, I mean, to quote the great geneticist, it was from UCL, J.B.S. Haldane, the universe is not queerer than we suppose. It's queerer than we can suppose. Mm-hmm. And almost certainly, there may be places where oxygen is much less available, and yet perhaps this self-replicating energy capture and processing, which is what life is all about, is taking place.
Can I just ask on a different practical thing near the end? I mean, obviously breathing's very practical as well in the use of oxygen and living stuff, but...
breathing's very practical.
It is. I tried stopping it for a while, but I'm just addicted. But I wondered about oxygen, like everything that anyone has any rough knowledge of, we then also find there are ways of people selling you tat. Oxygen bars, for instance, right? That was a hip thing. Did you ever go to that?
No, I never went, but that's what I was interested in. Also, quite often with things that I've worked, like beauty products and stuff, there's always things about kind of oxygenating your skin and all that kind of... So what... Is it all rubbish?
It's not all rubbish, actually, but some of it's rubbish.
Okay.
as usual. A bit of both.
Yeah.
Antioxidants. You get people go, yeah, I always take antioxidants, right? So antioxidants, right, my big jar of antioxidants, I don't have one, but what is that meant to be doing to my oxygen?
Okay, so here's the story. I mean, the oxygen bars, when Joseph Priestley first breathed oxygen, he said, oh, it makes me feel really nice. So it's nice. It's a different kind of feeling. You probably don't want to breathe pure oxygen for too long, although astronauts have done it, but and also people who are sick and oxygen tense, you know, it does actually really help. So oxygenating your skin, it's already pretty oxygenated, I would have thought. Breathing oxygen feels nice. Antioxidants, we've got plenty of them in our bodies already. If you eat enough fruit and vegetables, you've got plenty of them. And there's even some theories that if you eat antioxidant pills, then you might disrupt your own system. It's like bringing in a load of unruly mercenaries when you've already got a well-trained army. So you don't necessarily want to do that. But also, there's something very profound about the fact that oxygen is the reason we're not pinheads. It's the reason we're not slime. It's how we can be big and vigorous and creative and solve problems and be interesting. But it's actually also what kills us. Oxygen is responsible for all the diseases of old age and dementia and cancer and so on, and ultimately death by the rampaging it does with all these free radicals in your body. So the thing that you were breathing, there was one estimate that breathing for a year is the equivalent of having 10,000 chest x-rays. That's how much damage it's doing to you. And it's, our bodies are very impressive that they can resist it, but eventually you won't. So oxygen is the thing. It is the reason that we will all grow old and die. And yet it's the reason that we can all live.
So, Sarah, you've heard both sides of the argument and you've smelt the biscuit. So, how do you feel? Oxygen? Good thing, bad thing?
I feel like this is a remake with science of It's a Beautiful Life, where you get to find out about the past and what would have been like without oxygen, where there's kind of nothing, and then the future, what happens if we don't kind of protect the things that we've got, and then I wake up, and it's all a dream, and it's all okay, and we've got some oxygen, but we have to be careful now, guys. Is that the right thing? Have I taken? have I understood?
I also like the fact that that breathing thing. There's going to be a Fitbit that says, "Hold your breath for a little bit. We'll keep you younger."
You should stay young. Oh, it hurts my eyes.
Yeah, people do go up to high altitudes for that exact reason. So there's a new thing about going to a high altitude to have less oxygen. To live
That's
longer.
Why you're so young. The mountains, aren't you? I'm a little bit nearer the stars now. Up a lovely mountain. Look at me young skin. Robin lives in a cellar. That's why he's all old. So we asked the audience a question about oxygen, which we found very hard, actually. What did we want to ask them? So eventually what we came up with was Jean-Michel Jarre wrote an album all about oxygen. Which gas would you like there to be some kind of concept stroke prog album about? And these were our audience answers. Helium, because it will be uplifting. Oh, I'm awfully sorry, Joan. I thought you did very well, Jamie.
Freon. It's cool. It'd be a great chill-out ambient concept album.
Number one, album title, All I Want, Some Peace and Quiet. Number two, All the Songs Are Gone.
Are gone.
Not hydrogen.
G-O-N-E. For the listeners.
A poolside summer hit single by Dolly Parton. Chlorine. So there we are. Week we'll be asking, are insects taking over the world?
We're not really asking that. We're asking, why are insects more resilient than human beings, and why are they so successful? Why have they been around for so long?
Yeah, but if we ask, are insects taking over the world, we get pick of the day for the Daily Express. So we'll also then be asking, will the sun explode on Thursday?
No.
Are Martian superbugs about to destroy the Earth through disease?
No.
Okay, that's, we don't know what we're going to be doing next week then. Thanks. Bye-bye. In the infinite monkey cage. Without your trousers. In the infinite monkey
cage. Till now, nice again.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robin Ince, and in a change to the usual programme, The Infinite Monkey Cage has been replaced by Book at Tea Time. And today, this reading is an abridged version of Locusts by Guyenne Smith. The grasshoppers were still and silent, legs and antennae poised, an ominous hush. Only their eyes moved, huge evil orbs that saw the boy and the woman, flies caught in a spider's web. There was no need to hurry. They were trapped. She looked to David. She couldn't speak. He did not understand, was totally unaware of the danger. Oh, it's not tea time yet, is it, Mum? It is tea time, David. The grasshopper's tea time. Run! That was a reading from Locust by Guyenne Smith, and that was the first and last in the series of Locusts Escape from a Peach Tin Near Wales and Try to Take Over the World genre from the 1970s, which was also part of the Ants Take Over the World, Cockroaches Taking Over the World, and Assorted Bugs Taking Over the World novels of the 1970s, which were basically death intermingled with extraneous and pointless nude scenes to attract the teenage boy market.
This is why Robin ended up in the arts, you know, because I was thinking about Einstein, you know, just getting, like, mesmerised by locusts in a peach tin.
They are mesmerised. Genuinely, that is what the book's about. It is about locusts in a peach tin. It is one of the great works of locusts in a peach tin genre.
Anyway, today we're looking at the most numerous and diverse animals on the planet, insects. How did they evolve? Why are they so successful? And is it really true, as Robin said, that insects might one day
take over the world if kept in a peach tin for long enough?
To help us explore the world of insects, we have a distinguished panel of entomologists and Dave Gorman. And they are...
My name is Tim Cockerell. I'm a senior lecturer in natural history at the University of South Wales. And my favourite insect is the male fig wasp. He's small and very inconspicuous. He spends his whole life on the inside of a fig. He never sees the light of day, but he couldn't see the light of day because he doesn't have eyes. But he does have telescopic genitalia about twice the length of his own body, so it's not all bad.
And my name is Amaret Whittaker. I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Winchester. I'm a scientific associate of the Natural History Museum. I specialise in forensic entomology. My favourite insect is actually not usually related to forensics, but it is the flea. And this isn't why it's my favourite insect, but the male flea does actually have the most complicated genitalia of any organism in the living world.
Picking up a theme here.
My name is Dave Gorman. I am a man, and as a rational man, I don't have a favourite insect. But I do have a favourite trilobite, which is the genus Avalancurus. Yeah.
Is there anything about your genitalia you'd like to tell us to keep the theme running?
It's the most complicated genitalia of anyone in this room.
And this is our panel. Tim, we'll start with you. As this is about insects, we should start with a definition. What is an insect?
Yes, well, insects are a group of animals that belong to a larger group called the arthropods, the phylum Arthropoda. And they're those animals that are crunchy on the outside and soft on the inside. They've got their skeleton on the outside of their body. Now, the body plan of an insect, it consists